You're listening to the 6 o'clock news podcast from BBC Radio 4.
BBC News at 6 o'clock. This is Susan Ray. Good evening. A man has been arrested on suspicion of terrorism offences after a van hit a group of Muslim worshippers near a mosque in North London. Theresa May has described the attack as an act of hatred. An armed man has driven a car loaded with gas bottles into a police van on the Champs-Élysées in Paris. The Brexit Secretary, David Davis, has begun formal negotiations on the UK's withdrawal from the EU. A short time ago, he said the talks had got off to a promising start. The number of people believed to have died in the Grenfell Tower fire has risen to 79. A minute's silence has been held for the victims. Police are questioning a man on suspicion of terrorism offences after a van was driven into Muslim worshippers near a mosque in North London. One man died at the scene and 9 people were taken to hospital after the attack in Finsbury Park shortly after midnight. Witnesses said the driver shouted that he wanted to kill Muslims as he was pinned down by angry onlookers. A 47-year-old man, understood to be from South Wales, has been arrested. Theresa May called the attack sickening and said that evil would not succeed. Our Home Affairs correspondent Danny Shaw reports from Finsbury Park.
For the third time in 4 weeks, people in Britain woke to the news of what police quickly described as an act of terrorism targeted at Muslims. The attack took place shortly after midnight in an area crowded with worshippers. It's the holy month of Ramadan and they were taking a break between late-night prayers. According to witnesses, a white hire van sped along a bus lane before turning left into a courtyard near Muslim Welfare House, a local community centre and Finsbury Park Mosque. The van ploughed into about a dozen people who were giving first aid to an elderly man who earlier on had been taken ill. When the van driver got out, there were chaotic and violent scenes. Some people kicked and punched him, others called for him to be restrained. One man who was there, Abdul Rahman Adrous, said the suspect was trying to run away before passers-by managed to pin him to the floor.
People were coming over behind him to get him down to the ground, so he came past my side, attacked him down to the ground. With the help of other people, he was saying, I'm going to kill more people. And when he was on the ground, I asked him, why did you do that? Why? Innocent people. He goes, I want to kill Muslims.
The Imam of Muslim Welfare House, Mohammed Mahmoud, described how he'd helped shield the suspect from the angry crowd.
We managed to surround him and to protect him from any harm. We pushed people away from him until he was safely taken by police into custody and put into the back of the van. It wasn't me alone. There were a group of brothers who were calm and collected and managed to calm people down.
Some witnesses said police had responded too slowly, but Scotland Yard said its officers were on the scene in 1 minute, with backup arriving less than 10 minutes later. Police helped paramedics and members of the public treat those who were injured. Chris Norris was among those to assist.
There was 2 guys trying to lift the van off a guy who was trapped under it. And so that's when I decided that I was going to go in and try to help lift the van with him. We managed to get it high enough so we could get his leg out. But he was already bleeding from his head and his ears and stuff. So it wasn't just his leg that was trapped under, he was already severely damaged.
The man who'd been taken ill died at the scene, though it's still unclear whether that's linked to what happened. The Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Cressida Dick, said the attack had strengthened the force's resolve to protect communities and bring those responsible to justice.
We treat this as a terrorist attack, and we in the Met are as shocked as anybody in this local community or across the country at what has happened. We take all forms of hate crime and violent extremism incredibly seriously.
The BBC understands that the suspect is Darren Osborne from Cardiff. He grew up in Weston-super-Mare and has 4 children. Mr. Osborne, who was initially arrested on suspicion of attempted murder, is also now being held over alleged terrorism offences. Detectives believe the 47-year-old acted alone. The security minister, Ben Wallace, said he had not been known to the authorities before.
Theresa May chaired a meeting of the government's emergency committee this morning. Speaking afterwards in Downing Street, she said extra police were being deployed around mosques and she urged people to come together in the face of extremism. The Prime Minister then went to the Finsbury Park Mosque to meet community leaders. Our assistant political editor, Norman Smith, reports.
Severely criticised over her response to the Grenfell Tower tragedy, the Prime Minister today opted for a markedly different approach. Not only was Mrs. May swift to convene a meeting of the government's emergency committee, but she also visited the Finsbury Park Mosque this lunchtime to talk to elders. And speaking earlier in Downing Street, Mrs. May went out of her way to strike an engaged and compassionate note. The attack, she said, was not just directed against the Muslim community, but against common British values of freedom and tolerance. Mrs. May hailed London as an extraordinary city of extraordinary people who would not give in to such hate. And she was unequivocal in condemning the attack as an act of terrorism.
Our country woke to news of another terrorist attack on the streets of our capital city, the second this month, and every bit as sickening as those which have come before. It was an attack that once again targeted the ordinary and the innocent going about their daily lives. This time, British Muslims, as they left a mosque having broken their fast, and prayed together at this sacred time of year.
The Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, whose constituency includes Finsbury Park, spent part of the night at the scene talking to police and community leaders. Mr. Corbyn also attended prayers at the mosque this afternoon. Afterwards, the Labour leader urged people to remain calm.
As I see it, this is a terror on the streets and it's a terror of the people in the streets in the communities I'm very proud to represent in Parliament, and that's why I'm here today.
The Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, called on Londoners to stand together, but he also issued a stark warning to the government not to press ahead with planned cuts to police funding in the capital.
My message to the government is the plans you have to make the further cuts of £400 million, don't do it. My message to the government is the plans you have to change the police funding formula so London loses more money, don't do it. My message to the government is we need to get the right level of funding for a capital city.
In the meantime, ministers have promised there will be more police and more visible policing around mosques. The government is also expected to conduct a review of counter-terrorism that will include measures to confront not just Islamist extremism, but also Islamophobia directed against the Muslim community.
The Muslim Council of Britain condemned the Finsbury Park attack, saying ordinary people had been set upon as they went about their lives. The organisation called the attack the most violent manifestation to date of Islamophobia and called for more to be done to protect mosques. Here's our security correspondent Frank Gardner.
Within hours of the Finsbury Park attack, online supporters of so-called Islamic State were citing it as proof of what they see as widespread hostility towards Muslims living in the West. While this is patently untrue, there has been universal condemnation of the attack across Britain. There is a growing problem here of far-right extremism. Whereas MI5, the security service, takes the lead in monitoring suspected jihadists inspired by IS, it's the job of the police to watch far-right extremists. The number of people referred to them for far-right extremism has more than trebled in the past 4 years, from 172 a year to 561. Even before this attack occurred, there had been numerous reported acts of Islamophobic hatred around the country, often aimed at mosques. Those attacks play right into the hands of IS recruiters and propagandists, since the one thing that violent Islamists have in common with far-right extremists is a belief that Muslims and non-Muslims cannot peacefully coexist. In their efforts to divide our society, both kinds of extremists are likely to continue to provoke a reaction wherever they can.
Our religious affairs correspondent Martin Bashir has spent the day near the Finsbury Park Mosque. He found there was anger among many, but also an attempt by faith leaders to prevent divisions opening between different groups.
With temperatures and tensions rising in North London, the chairman of Finsbury Park Mosque, Mohammed Cosbar, offered some words of unity following the attack which took place during the early hours of this morning.
An attack on one faith is an attack on all faith and communities. Those who try to divide us and who aim to spread fear, hatred and division will not succeed.
Along with the Prime Minister and Jeremy Corbyn, whose constituency includes the Finsbury Park Mosque, Communities Secretary Sajid Javid also came to visit the crime scene. And, during a brief press conference, he was interrupted by a local Muslim mother, Runa Begum.
Muslim, how do I keep my son and I safe? Because we don't. We don't feel safe at the moment.
After Sajid Javid offered some words of consolation, Runa Begum spoke to reporters.
As a Muslim, you feel so pushed out. It's the month of Ramadan for me as well. We're really struggling and we've been trying, going to Grenfell, like trying to find these survivors. It's just one thing after another and I'm so tired. I'm so tired having to explain this to an eight-year-old.
An expression by many within a community that has a rich history of multicultural engagement, but one that has been shattered by the events of last night.
Police in Paris have sealed off the Champs-Élysées after a car was driven into a police van, bursting into flames. The driver of the car, who was armed, was killed. No one else has been injured. From Paris, Hugh Schofield reports.
Mid-afternoon, the driver of a white Renault directed his car against the lead vehicle in a convoy of police vans on the Champs-Élysées, not far from the Élysée Palace. In the moments that followed, there was an explosion on board the car and clouds of smoke could be seen escaping. Police extracted the man from the car and his body was left lying on the ground as sniffer dogs and bomb defusal experts checked that the area was safe. Police are treating it as a terrorist incident. On board the car, they found a gas bottle, handguns and a Kalashnikov assault rifle. French media report that the man was in his early 30s and known to the intelligence services.
Almost a year after the people of Britain voted to leave the European Union, the first formal negotiations aimed at setting the terms of the country's departure have begun in Brussels. Welcoming his British counterpart to the Commission's headquarters, the EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, said he hoped the talks would be held in a constructive atmosphere. The Brexit Secretary, David Davis, also struck a positive note, stressing a determination to forge a new and special partnership. In the past half hour, the two men emerged from their first day of talks to declare that the negotiations had got off on the right foot, with the two sides agreeing on dates, organisation and priorities. Mr Davis also said he hoped for a quick deal on citizens' rights. Our Europe correspondent Kevin Connolly is in Brussels, from where he's just sent this report.
Whatever else may ultimately divide the two sides as these talks progress, they had a shared interest in at least getting them underway. The UK wants to show it's ready and able to negotiate after the election left the government without a parliamentary majority. The EU feels that the timetable is already uncomfortably tight. The European side has shaped the timetable for the talks, which will turn to a future trade deal only after Michel Barnier is satisfied that enough progress is being made on divorce arrangements. That means mutual citizens' rights, future arrangements on the Irish border, and the size of any terminal payment from the UK. Mr Barnier said this phase of the talks was about tackling the uncertainties created by Brexit, not about hostility to the UK.
A fair deal is possible, and far better than no deal. That is what I said to David today. That is why we will work all the time with the UK and never against the UK.
The formal exchange of gifts invited talk of an uphill task to come. A walking stick from the hilly Savoy region of France for Mr Davis and a book about mountaineering in the Himalayas for Mr Barnier. But while acknowledging the scale of the task before them, Mr Davis was keener to talk about the ultimate goal of a new relationship between the EU and the only member state ever to leave it. He offered this quote, attributed by him to Churchill, to sum up his views.
There's no doubt that the road ahead will at times be challenging, but as Winston Churchill once said, the pessimist sees difficulty in every opportunity. The optimist sees opportunity in every difficulty.
The clock ticking on the UK's departure from the EU was started in March when the government invoked Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, and British membership will cease in March 2019 as things stand. That leaves less than 2 years for these complex negotiations, a tight time frame compared with the 10.5 years of talks it took to get Britain into the European community more than 40 years ago.
As the negotiations got underway in Brussels, debate in the UK about what strategy should be pursued has gathered momentum. Yesterday, the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, confirmed it was still the plan to leave both the EU single market and the customs union, but he insisted the UK should get there via a slope, not a cliff edge. Our political correspondent Ian Watson reports from Westminster.
British businesses, the opposition and some government ministers have been making it clear they want the needs of the economy to be at the forefront of the Brexit negotiations. This is usually code for putting jobs ahead of immigration. The new Environment Secretary, Michael Gove, answering questions on the BBC about the needs of the rural economy, appeared to agree.
I need to develop a granular appreciation of how the industry works, where the pinch points in the labour market might be, what needs to be done in order to ensure that the rural economy can continue to grow. There's an absolute commitment from the Prime Minister and from all of us in Cabinet that when it comes to shaping new migration policy, the economy comes first.
Those comments from the leading Leave campaigner Michael Gove might upset those who expected to see a dramatic fall in immigration after Brexit. But in the short term, the talks with the EU are more likely to focus not on the overall levels of immigration, but on who controls it. And the argument within Theresa May's cabinet isn't so much over the ultimate destination, with the UK outside of the single market and the customs union, but how long it takes to get there. The Chancellor, Philip Hammond, is likely to press for a relatively lengthy period of transition, which might allow for a high level of EU migration and customs union membership for a period beyond Brexit. But the shadow Brexit Secretary, Sir Keir Starmer, suggested Theresa May had been too swift in restricting the issues for negotiation in the first place.
The Prime Minister's been far too quick to take options off the table. What she did was really to sweep off the table any meaningful discussion about the customs union, any meaningful discussion about the single market, any meaningful discussion about the European court, and to play up the idea that even leaving with no deal is viable as an option, which it clearly isn't.
For the government, Brexit still means Brexit, but it's less clear how long it will take to leave the main institutions of the European Union.
The number of people believed to have died in the Grenfell Tower fire in West London last week has risen to 79. The Metropolitan Police have warned that the figure could change. A minute's silence for the dead was observed at Grenfell House and across the UK at 11 o'clock this morning, as our correspondent Peter Hunt reports.
From inside a tower that an uncontainable fire turned into a blackened tomb came those who were trying to find the bodies and establish the cause. Firefighters put their arms around each other, and with local people they paused at 11 o'clock.
Three! Dismissed!
Five of the deceased have been formally identified. 74 others are missing, presumed dead. Many families have lost more than one relative. The intensity of the blaze means some of those who perished may never be identified. Metropolitan Police Commander Stuart Cundy went inside Grenfell Tower at the weekend.
Having been in there myself, it's really hard to describe the devastation that the fire has caused. I've investigated major crime for most of my service, and I've seen some terrible things, but I don't think anything prepared me for what I was going to see when I was in there.
Let us pray. O God, whose only begotten Son, by his light...
People have been praying, crying and leaving flowers, candles and messages. After criticism of the initial handling of this crisis by local and national government, those left homeless are receiving money from an emergency fund and a more visible presence on the streets has been promised. I put this to the test with one resident.
Have you seen people in high visibility vests?
Not one single one.
And you've looked, you've been around?
Yeah, of course, I've been here every day. We haven't left, you know.
But since Theresa May promised, no?
No, nothing. No information, no empathy. The only people helping are people.
As in volunteers?
Yeah, and volunteers, of course.
This is a grieving, saddened and angry community that has the tower as a visible reminder of their considerable loss. A sign by a police cordon reads, "Stop taking pictures, please. This is not a tourist attraction."
The BBC has seen letters which reveal that four separate government ministers were warned that fire regulations were not keeping people safe. The leaked documents show experts across the UK had warned that lives were being put at risk in high-rise blocks like Grenfell Tower. Panorama has also learned that firefighters called to Grenfell Tower last week put out the initial fire inside a flat, only to discover it had spread to the outside of the building. This report from Panorama's Richard Bilton.
The leaked letters show MPs have been worried about fire safety in tower blocks for years. Following a fatal fire in South London in 2009, a series of recommendations were made to keep people safe. Nothing was changed. The government promised a review of fire regulations in 2013, but it's never been published. Panorama has obtained dozens of letters sent by the Parliamentary Fire Safety Group. Informed by experts, they warned the government could not afford to wait for another tragedy. Four ministers received letters but didn't strengthen the regulations. Ronnie King is a former chief fire officer who sits on the group.
We have spent 4 years saying, listen, we've got the evidence, we've provided you with the evidence, there is clear public opinion towards this, and I think, you know, you ought to move on it.
The government today said there was still no timetable for a review. In a separate development, Panorama has discovered that firefighters put out the first fire at Grenfell Tower. They were called to a fridge fire and within minutes told residents the fire was out in the flat. The crew was leaving the building when firefighters outside spotted flames rising up the side of the building. The Fire Brigades Union says firefighters were left facing an unprecedented fire and officers broke their own safety protocols to rescue people.
Panorama, London Tower Fire, Britain's Shame will be shown on BBC One at 8:30 tonight. 250 police officers are now working on the fire investigation, which Commander Stuart Cundy has promised will be exhaustive. He said the investigation would not just look at how the fire started, but why it spread so quickly. Our legal affairs correspondent, Clive Coleman, examines what criminal charges are possible.
Organisations can be prosecuted for manslaughter, but it's not easy. The offence of corporate manslaughter was created in 2007 to provide criminal accountability for very serious management failings. A prosecution has to prove that senior management organised systems and controls in a way that caused death and amounted to a gross breach of the duty of care it owed to those who died. Big companies and organisations have layers of management, policies and training on safety. So it's very difficult to prove the top people had put in place systems that were so poor as to create a substantial risk of death. There have been pitifully few prosecutions and generally of small companies. Specific individuals within organisations could be prosecuted for gross negligence manslaughter. That's also difficult because gross negligence means you have to prove something much worse than just a bad mistake. It's far more likely that organisations and individuals would be prosecuted under health and safety law. The bar's far lower here as there's no requirement to prove senior managers created systems that risk death, merely that they created a danger to people who are owed a duty of care. Although these offences can be punishable with substantial fines and prison sentences, the very words health and safety rarely satisfy the public when avoidable tragedies happen and multiple deaths occur.
Emergency workers in central Portugal are continuing to evacuate areas in the path of major forest fires, which are so far known to have killed at least 62 people. Hundreds of firefighters are tackling the blazes, which are thought to have been started by a lightning strike on Saturday. Survivors have been recounting narrow escapes, including a dozen people who sought refuge from the flames in a water tank. James Reynolds has been to the region where relief aid is being flown in.
Here in central Portugal, a haze of smoke has almost blocked out the sun. Blackened trees on either side of the road are still smouldering, and relief planes fly overhead. Portugal has more forest fires than any other country in southern Europe. It's had years to make proper preparations, to thin forests, to build refuges within homes. And yet in these fires, dozens of people have died. Many were killed on a single road. The fire engulfed families in their cars as they tried to drive to safety. On Saturday, the village of Noderinho watched as the first fires approached. There was no way for anyone to leave. So a dozen residents jumped into a water tank to avoid the flames. 84-year-old Marta de Concepcion was helped in by her daughter. She now rests exhausted opposite her home. Oh God, oh God, it was awful, she told me. The fires were like hell. The rescue efforts continues during a three-day period of national mourning. And Portugal now asks why its most isolated residents were left to save themselves.
Three women and a man have been convicted in connection with the brutal torture and murder of a vulnerable man in Tyneside. Newcastle Crown Court heard that Jimmy Prout, who was from North Shields, was violently abused over several months before his body was dumped in bushes last year. Fiona Trott reports on a case which has some disturbing details.
45-year-old Jimmy Prout thought the group of four were his friends. But month after month, they tortured him to such an extent that he died from his injuries. He would post pictures of himself on his Facebook account saying, "My body hurt" and "My shoulder hurts." The court heard the violence was extreme. His teeth were removed with a hammer and chisel, and another part of his body was mutilated. When he died, the father of two was then dumped on wasteland. Newcastle Crown Court heard the group feigned concern. They pretended to look for him, but all the while were stealing money from his bank account. Northumbria police described it as an appalling level of abuse. 43-year-old Zahid Zaman and 26-year-old Anne Corbett were convicted of murder. Zaman was described as vengeful and controlling in court. He uses a wheelchair, and Detective Chief Inspector Andy Fairlam said he told the women what to do.
Zahid Zaman was the person who was at the heart of what was going on. He was the person directing the three females who he was with, and they were working at his behest. They were acting on his instructions, and the evidence at the court demonstrated that he was the person who was instructing them to carry out his actions.
50-year-old Myra Wood and 56-year-old Kay Rayworth were convicted of causing or allowing the death of a vulnerable adult. All four will be sentenced later this month.
In the city, the 100 share index closed up 60 points at 7,524. In New York a short time ago, the Dow Jones was up 115 at 21,499. On the currency markets, the pound is down 0.5 cents at $1.27.4. And against the euro, sterling is down 0.3 cents at €1.14, making a euro worth 87.7 pence. The United Nations says it will strip Liverpool of its World Heritage status next year unless planned high-rise developments on the city's historic waterfront are shelved. An area of 130 hectares of the city was given the honour in 2004. UNESCO first expressed concern 5 years ago, as Danny Savage reports.
Of the two dozen or so UNESCO World Heritage sites in the UK, Liverpool is the only one under threat. A large chunk of the city centre is covered by the status, with UNESCO describing it as a supreme example of a commercial port at the time of Britain's greatest global influence. The status acknowledges the architecture associated with Liverpool's hugely influential past. Its most famous landmarks include the Royal Liver Building and the Cunard offices on the waterfront. But planned developments in the area are putting its status under threat. UNESCO has complained about this in the past, but now it has gone a step further and set a definitive date for deleting Liverpool from its list of World Heritage Sites. Henrietta Billings is the director of Save Britain's Heritage, a group which campaigns for historic buildings.
It's a highly coveted status that puts Liverpool on the world stage. It attracts visitors and boosts the local economy. To lose it because of crass planning decisions would be an international embarrassment and a hugely costly mistake. The message is loud and clear. You have 1 year to get your house in order. Act now or you lose your World Heritage site.
UNESCO is now demanding the government steps in and deals with the planning issues. It is particularly alarmed by proposals for a 34-storey apartment block on the waterfront. In response, the government has said it doesn't have the power to limit the granting of local planning decisions. Last year, the Mayor of Liverpool, Jo Anderson, rejected UNESCO's plea to limit developments, saying he didn't want to stifle growth in the city. The coming months will reveal if there is the will to protect the Liverbird statues and their surrounds as a World Heritage Landmark.
The children's presenter and actor Brian Cant has died at the age of 83. His agent said he'd had Parkinson's disease for some time. Brian Cant was best known for hosting the BBC children's programmes Play School and Play Away in the 1970s and early 80s. The headlines again. A man is being questioned on suspicion of terrorism offences after a van was driven into Muslim worshippers near Finsbury Park Mosque in London. One man died at the scene. 9 people were taken to hospital. An armed man has rammed a car carrying bottles of gas into a police van in Paris. The first formal Brexit talks have taken place in Brussels, with the Brexit Secretary David Davis saying he hopes for a swift deal on mutual rights for EU and British citizens. BBC News.
For more reports and information, search online for Radio 4 6 o'clock news or use the hashtag Radio 4 6.